Welcome to Discovery's podcast. We're glad you're joining us today. If you'd like to know more about us, you can check out our website, dc2.me, or follow along on our socials. And now, here is this week's sermon.
Got to click that on, huh? It's not going to work if I don't turn it on. Good morning. Good to see all of you. My name's Drew. I'm one of the pastors here, and it's good to be with you today. Over the last 2 weeks, we've been in our Advent series here in the first chapter of the book of John, and so far, we've not yet made it through the first sentence. So we're going to do that today. We'll finish this first sentence and really the first complete thought of the book, which is, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. What a line. Yeah, like what a way to open a book. And something I love about these first two sentences is that even without a lot of in-depth study or totally understanding definitions, you can hear the power of this line. And this is the work of a really good author. An author who has conviction in the story that they're telling and understands the story well enough to capture both your attention and the essence of the story, all in the very first thought that they write. So this is what we have today, a really good hook. A hook, this is an attention grabber at the beginning of a song or a book or a movie. And a really good hook not only draws you in at first, but forever. Some of the most famous stories and movies are identifiable by their very first sentence. So we're going to try something. We're going to loosen ourselves up, get ourselves engaged for the morning. I'm going to read some first sentences of some pretty famous stories or movies. And if you know what they're from, you just yell it out. Cool? Yeah, all right, here we go. First one, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Yeah. Oh, good. You're right there with me. All right. This next one, you'll probably not even have to hear the whole sentence. My mama always said life is like a box of chocolate. Yep. Yep. Good job. All right. This one's a little trickier, but think about it. I think you'll get it. All children except one grow up. Ah, yay. I wasn't sure. Good job, y'all. All right. This next one's the hardest one. Maybe. Maybe I shouldn't say that. I believe in America. America has made my fortune. Yeah, say it louder. Oh, no. Sorry, I thought you said something else. Sorry. It's The Godfather. That's from The Godfather. All right, two more. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Very good. This is the next one, the last one. It's my favorite of the whole group, especially given the season. Marley was dead to begin with. Yes, very good. Again, another Dickens. Man, what's up with that guy? Good job. Okay, so before we move on, I just want to give some friendly advice and a little bit of a recommendation. Of all of the Christmas Carol movies, The Muppets Christmas Carol is the best one. Oh, and the heavens sing. Am I right? I was telling a friend earlier this week, I was like, Michael Caine, this is a serious actor, giving the performance of a lifetime with puppets as co-stars, right? Watch, do yourself a favor. Watch a Muppets Christmas Carol. It's on Disney Plus. Watch a Muppets Christmas Carol. So John here, he's telling the greatest story ever told. And he writes it in such a way that you're not only drawn in at first, but every time you hear that opening line, you're transported right back into the story. Because, like good storytellers, John here is answering a fundamental question. So, for instance, some of these stories we just mentioned, they're answering a question. They're pointing to an ultimate truth. So, Christmas Carol teaches us that a life of generosity is freedom, and a life of selfishness is imprisonment, right? So I hear Marley was dead to begin with, and I instantly see his ghostly figure shackled and chained in the afterlife because of the decisions he made in his earthly life. Or I hear all children except one grow up, and I instantly see Wendy realizing through her friend Peter Pan that prolonging childhood, at least the way that Peter Pan does it, is to distort it, and that growing up without losing our sense of wonder is important. So with this opening thought, the Spirit, through John, is already at work answering a fundamental question. And we looked at some questions last week. If you were here, Zach called them human questions. And today, I would submit that with the completion of this first thought, John is answering the primary question of all of creation. Who is this Jesus? So because we're completing the first sentence, it's important to talk about what we've covered so we don't pull ourselves out of context. So first, we're going to read the entirety of verses 1 and 2. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. So 2 weeks ago, in the first week, we looked at just the first four words, in the beginning was. And we learned that John is pulling directly from Genesis with his language, but he shifts it just a little. In Genesis, we have in the beginning when. Here in John, we have in the beginning was. Genesis is concerned with what is happening. John is concerned with who is happening. And then last week, we sat with that who, the Word. Zach showed us all the layers of meaning that John was communicating by choosing that word, Word. And we learned that this Word is a person. This Word is Jesus. Again, that's what John is concerned with here. Who is this Jesus? So we start to see his answer straight away. John says, and the Word was with God. The Word, Jesus, was with God. Now, if you've been around the church for a while, if you've been a believer as long as you can remember, this next bit might feel like a refresher course, and that's good. It's really good to always be working on the fundamentals. That's true of everything. It's certainly true here. But if this is new for you, first of all, awesome. Welcome. We need you and we need your perspective for those of us who have grown overly familiar. So lean in with us. And if this is old, same thing. Lean in with us. This word with, it shows us that at the beginning, Jesus was there. He was with God. You don't need a seminary degree to understand what John is asserting here. So we're just going to talk through it with practical examples, inch our way in. If you were to call me when I'm in the car doing school pickup and you ask, where are your kids? And I say, they're with me. Well, then your assumption is that they are physically present to me. You would think they're where? In the car, in the car. If someone can be said to be with another, then the two are differentiated. We have different people. So in my example, my children, they're distinct people apart from me, but they're in the car. They're near to me. So in the beginning, wherever God was, Jesus was there too. And this is a really astonishing claim that, again, for those of us who've been around for a while, I think it can get lost on us. So let's think about this through the eyes of the early readers and listeners of this story. Remember, this book was written when some from the community of original Jesus followers were still alive. So to make this claim that this real, like, enfleshed person, who they knew to be a couch-surfing, wilderness-wandering, miracle-working preacher, to say that he was somehow physically present with God at the very beginning is a wild claim. But even so, their astonishment would have gone further. And this is where more study and those folks from the seminaries who write the books, they do really help us out here. Because this word with, it has a much deeper meaning than our simple English word. The original word, pros, it can be and is correctly translated as with. It's just that that's a little shallow in comparison to its full meaning. So another helpful word to help paint a more dynamic picture is the word toward, or even face to face. You see, not only was Jesus there, he was face to face with God, held by the loving gaze of the Father and himself returning that loving gaze. So what we're talking about here is not just proximity. What we're talking with this word with is intimacy. Not just proximity, intimacy. And that might confront us with maybe a new reality that God is not some stoic, alone, far-off figure, but he exists in relationship. And before anything else was, that relationship was. Before anything was, that loving gaze was. Oh, sweet baby. So who is this Jesus? The Word with God. He is his own distinct being who exists in intimate relationship with God. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. John continues to answer this question with another astonishingly bold claim. And again, it doesn't take a lot of searching to understand the statement John is making here. And if we sit with it for just a moment, I don't think it takes much searching to understand the weight of what John is saying here. He was God. He's not mincing words, and that's deliberate. This Jesus was not only present to God always, but he was and is God always. This is a claim that is not just bold, though it certainly is. It is essential because it confronts confusion and heresy, both of John's time and our own, by the way. We'll get there in a minute. It confronts it head on. Because if Jesus is God, then Jesus is not lesser than God. Jesus was not created by God, not merely a good teacher, not merely an influential man for whom we should study. Not just the Word with God, but God with God. What the Word is what God is. And to John, it is crucial that you know this right at the beginning. That the Word, that Jesus is God, distinctive, yes, but also divine. It is because Jesus is and was both distinct with God and divine, was God, that I would say Advent means anything at all. Advent, arrival, that's what this season means. We're waiting for an arrival. So then who is coming? John says, God is coming, and that changes everything. In fact, the whole dang thing hinges right here on this. You see, after verse 1, which reads, "In the beginning was the Word," see if you can do that with me, "and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Excellent. Verse 2 seems to repeat that. He was with God in the beginning. But like we've already seen in our comparison to Genesis 1, John isn't just copy and pasting. Biblical authors never do that. Everything is intentional. Which means this repetition should cause us to look further. John is communicating something a little bit different. In the same way that he shifted "in the beginning when" to "in the beginning was," we've had another word shift. It's no longer the Word we're talking about here, but a he. He was with God in the beginning. And like pretty much everything else from these first two sentences, I think we can overlook this statement because of familiarity, but we have got to slow down. We cannot afford to miss what's going on here. John is doing a lot of work with just a 7-word verse. He is, at minimum, conveying 3 different truths about Jesus in just 1 sentence. So first, we're going to look at this sentence by considering the most obvious thing, the repetition. As I said, biblical authors don't merely repeat themselves. They don't just copy and paste from other biblical literature accidentally. And for our purposes today, it's important to know that punctuation, as we see it today, didn't really exist back then. Repetition was their way of highlighting or exclaiming, pointing to the importance of something. So verse 2 is John's way of saying, verse 1 is really important. Like I said, the whole thing is riding on this. And for John, clarifying this point wasn't just helpful, it was necessary. Because in his day, for some, this whole idea was clouded with confusion. There was another religion, or like a system of religions called Gnosticism, that had many ideas that opposed the truth of Jesus. But the one John is concerned with here, and this is for sure an oversimplification, but it was this idea that there was a supreme God that was somehow separate, like detached outside of the material world. And that the one who created the material world, they called this whatever the demiurge, that sounds super Stranger Things, was a lesser or imperfect being. They said that this being was likely in the mind of God from eternity, but not in eternity itself. So John doubles down. Who is this Jesus? He was the one in the beginning, at creation. He was and is God. And if you didn't hear me the first time, Jesus, God himself, was the one there at the beginning, not separate, not lesser, distinct, yes, but divine. True God from true God, as the Nicene Creed painted right there on our wall says it. And the truth is, we need John's clarity today. If you know me, you know I like numbers. I think they make things concrete for us, kind of wake us up to the truth a little bit. And in a sermon of mine not long ago, I cited the State of Theology report on what American evangelicals believe about the person and the role of the Holy Spirit. Well, today, we're going to cite the same report, but it's been updated since just this past September. And today, we're going to talk about the role and the person of Jesus in the mind of the American evangelical. 49%, that's almost half of respondents, agreed that Jesus was a great teacher, but not God. Even though 70% said they believe there is one true God in 3 persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, which that 70% is a frightening number altogether and differently, but these two together, they indicate confusion at best, and at worst, poor or neglectful teaching. Remember, we cannot afford to miss this. John is here to set the record straight. This Jesus, he was present to and present as God from the very beginning. And as clear and beautiful as that is, John says, oh, roll up your sleeves. There's a little bit more. This original word that we translate as he was with God in the beginning, that first word, much like the words with and was from the previous verse, is more dynamic than it appears. But to be sure, he is an appropriate translation. It's just not the only translation. The word we're using here is houtos, and when used as an object, it can be and is translated as he or her or it or them, depending on the context. But its base definition, is this one. Or some really fun friends, when rendering it in this context, say, this is the one. This is the one who was with God in the beginning. See, all of a sudden, the tone seems to change. We go from the question at hand being applied in John's statement in verse 1 to the answer of a seemingly different question in verse 2. We move from who is this Jesus to who is this one? I mean, we're one sentence in. Let's think about it. We're given the main character of the story straight away. We're told who he is, all in the first sentence. But with this subject change, John seems to be answering a question in a conversation that is already happening. A conversation that seemingly we don't yet see in this book, unless John doesn't consider this to be the beginning of the dialogue. And if that's true, then what is? What is the question he's answering, and who is asking it? You know, the entirety of the scriptures is actually the story of Advent. A story of God's people waiting for an arrival. And through times of suffering and times of prosperity, God's people have had the same question on their lips. And John knows this question. He knows his Hebrew Bible. He undoubtedly asked this question himself for a while, at least. And he connects us to this question by starting his book with Genesis in the first place. And why do that? Why tie us to Genesis? Well, because he needs you to know the whole conversation. You may have heard the story at the beginning of Genesis, right? Like God creates everything, the world, the plants, the animals, sky, sea, and then finally the humans. But these humans, under the influence of talking snake, it's a great story, you should read it, they have a deceiver. This deceiver convinces them to break some rules, and there are consequences. Consequences for the humans, yes, no doubt, we know what that's like, we're living here on earth. But consequences for the deceiver, too. And God speaks directly to the particulars of these consequences straight away, and he tells the snake, "The child of the woman will crush your head, and you will bruise the child's heel." Maybe tuck that one away for later. But ever since that moment, all of creation has asked, well, then who? Who is the one who will take on the deceiver, who will crush his head and make all things right? And this question is woven throughout the Old Testament. And we have really wonderful figures who come on the scene, and they're there to lead God's people. And so we're like, oh, could this be the one? No. Could that be the one? No. People like Noah and Moses and Aaron and Deborah and David and Solomon and more. And these people are incredible. They are called and they are equipped by the Lord, but they're still human, just like you and me. And ultimately, they are unable to be the one that all of creation needs to make things right. So we keep looking. We keep waiting. We keep asking, who is the one? Psalm 24. The earth is the Lord's and all its fullness. The world and those who dwell therein, for he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the waters. Who may ascend into the hill of the Lord, or who may stand in his holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to an idol nor sworn deceitfully, he shall receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. This is Jacob, the generation of those who seek him, who seek your face. Lift up your heads, all you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord strong and mighty. The Lord mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, all you gates. Lift up, you everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is this King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory. The psalmist asks, who? Who is the one pure enough, holy enough, strong enough that the gates and doors of the foundations of the earth would open up for them? And the psalmist isn't asking and then answering his own question, because the one he seeks is somehow individual enough to receive blessing, righteousness, and salvation from the Lord, but also worthy enough to be called Lord themselves. Okay, let's look ahead. Proverbs 30. There's this moment where the author is conceding the limits of humanity and his own limits. And so he asks, who has gone up to heaven and come down? Whose hands have gathered up the wind? Who has wrapped up the waters in a cloak? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name and what is the name of his son? Who is the one who created all of this in the first place? What are their names? And God himself, who he knows the urgency and the importance of this question, and he is so eager to give the answer because he knows it's going to change everything. And so he chimes in Isaiah 44, and he's telling his people that redemption and salvation are coming. And he says, you can trust in me because of what happened in creation. I am the Lord who made all things, who stretched out the heavens alone, who spread out the earth. Who was with me? Another translation says, tell me, who was with me? Who is this King of glory? Tell me the names of those at creation. And God himself says, who was with me? They all cry out together, who is the one who will make things right again? So when John sits down to write, he knows his Hebrew Bible, and he knows the question that has been woven throughout the scriptures and woven throughout his people's existence. And when they ask, who is the one spoken of from the beginning? John knows. Who will destroy the deceiver and make things right? John knows. And he says, this is the one. Who is this Jesus? He is the Word of God who was with God and was God in the very beginning. He is the one that all of creation has been waiting for. And it is his distinctiveness, his ability to become one of us, and his divinity, his absolute identity as God, that makes him the only one fit for the job. And man, that would be enough. Wouldn't that be enough? But it would not have been enough for Jesus. For Jesus, there is still one more question to answer. Like we said earlier, John shifts the subject in verse 1 from the Word to he in verse 2. And it seems this one little word is not done with us yet. The master of layered meaning. John uses this word specifically to imply the more personal nature of the one that he's talking about. We've gone from formal to informal, from title to person. And that matters because a person can be known. And to know is to be in relationship, to be with another. And do we remember what with looks like for Jesus? It's not just proximity. It's intimacy. And is it possible that this face-to-face posture of God and the Word that we discovered earlier, their existence being rooted in a relationship of loving gazes that they share, is it possible that that might be how Jesus exists in relationship with you? Is this the connection John is trying to make? Later in this very book, in chapter 17, we're told that God loves us with the same love that he has for Jesus. And not only that, but that he sees us just like he sees Jesus. And if we read that in chapter 17, then we must read it through the lens of the very beginning of this book. And again, for like the third time today, that changes everything. In the same way that the Word, that Jesus and God the Father, that they exist in a relationship of perfect love, John is saying, y'all, you can get in on that too. The Word, Jesus, is personal, knowable. And it means that Jesus is the one for you too. That he was there at your very beginning. The answer to every longing of your soul, every question in your heart. The one that all of creation has cried out for comes not just for the whole, but for the individual. He comes for you. He has heard your cries too. You see, verse 2 doesn't just repeat. Verse 2 refines. What we thought we knew in verse 1 gets so much better. Good stories written by good authors often hook us by the heart from the very first words, catching both our attention and the essence of their message in just a few sentences, ensuring that the answer to whatever fundamental question they're addressing stays with you much longer than the time it takes to read their words. I don't think John is just a good author, and I don't think this is just a good story. I think John is brilliant, and the story even more so. Of course, to be fair, he had really excellent source material and an all-knowing co-writer, so he had a little bit of a leg up. But when he hooks you with those first sentences, you're not just transported into the story, but you're pulled into the fabric of creation, crying out with those who have gone before you, who is the one? Who are we waiting for? Prepare your hearts, friends. It's Advent. And God is coming. The one who is the answer to all of it, and he came for you. So, why Advent? Why do we in our church, from a tradition that doesn't observe this season the same way that some of our high church brothers and sisters do? We observe Advent here because it causes us to contemplate the deeper things of this season. To not just be passive observers, but intentional participants. Again, there is far too much here for us to miss out on it. So I'm going to call the band out. And with that, we're going to spend some time here being intentional participants. We're going to rest in a contemplative moment and ask ourselves a few questions. We're going to focus on the personal nature of the word. So maybe if it's helpful, just take a deep breath, or four or five or six, and ask the Spirit to help us still our minds. Ask the only one who is able to meet you right where you are this morning, the only place you can actually be.